Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, July 31st. Wildfire preparedness is on our radar as communities across the state deal with the threat during this dry season. Today, we take a look at the risks to Waikoloa neighborhoods on the island of Hawaii. We also talk to a local actor and author who was recently commissioned by two mainland theaters to write a play about Hawaii. We'll hear why he had a change of heart after first turning down the opportunity. And with summer coming to a close, beach days for kids winding down, we revisit an interview with a local entrepreneur who makes beach toys from compostable plastic. Plus, a state-of-the-art recording studio on Oahu has a soft opening. We get a sneak peek. You may be surprised to know it's at a public middle school campus. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A brush fire on the Big Island and other blazes on Kauai that triggered evacuations earlier this month is a reminder about the need to be mindful of the fire risk in drought-prone areas. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote rode along with the county emergency management officials recently to look at evacuation routes in Waikoloa. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, this is your backyard.
Yes, I actually grew up in North Kona on the Big Island, so I'm very, very familiar with this area. And Waikoloa is one of the communities that we're looking at in looking at how different islands are dealing with fire risk. It is one of the communities that has a one-way-in, one-way-out access point for a community of about 7,000 people on a major road. However, they do have an evacuation route, and that's what I had the opportunity to drive down. It's called, some call it the Waikoloa Village Hulu Evacuation Road. And this road was put to the test in 2021 during the Mauna Road Fire. That was a major fire on Big Island that burned 40,000 acres near the village. I spoke with Mayor Mitch Ross, who had called on residents to evacuate from Waikoloa during that fire. And he said that there were some serious lessons that were learned from that event.
Couple of things. One route isn't enough. The route was pretty much a Jeep trail. We decided to work together with the state. We got cold plain material. That's the material from roads when they dig them up. And we use that cold plain material to pave that road. So it's a more even road, and it's a lot safer for people to drive on. We're also looking at possibility of turning that into a two-lane road. Time matters when you're doing an evacuation, so we realize that more options that we have and better maintained options make the situation a lot better. At that time, I also started looking at other possibilities to find other roads that were out, and we found some people that were building, we found some landowners that would maybe be willing to open up that a second road out of Waikoloa Village.
Yeah. And that one road in, one road out is something that so many communities across the state face. You know, all the ridges in East Honolulu, I mean, that's a fact of life.
Absolutely. And we've been having this conversation, of course, with the understanding of the devastating events that happened on August 8th and asking questions about what other communities that have fire risk might be doing to prevent similar tragedies. And Mitch Roth was adamant that this is something that's been top of his list in terms of priorities since before August 8th. So what he really wanted and what he's working on is having Waikoloa have a second evacuation route. So they have the one major thoroughfare that's a public road in and out right now. They have the Hulu Street evacuation route, which we were just talking about, that recently paved one-lane road that is locked during normal circumstances and then unlocked by emergency managers during a disaster event such as a wildfire. And they just did a groundbreaking blessing on what will be a second emergency route that could be open by at some point over the next year. And that road is developed in partnership with a handful of private land openers or a handful of private landowners. And that's a really unique situation that we don't see in a lot of these other communities, the ability to build multiple roads around a surrounding town. It's not something you can necessarily do in other communities where the topography has more steep terrain.
Yeah, and that can be pretty expensive.
Yeah, and so that's another thing that makes the situation really unique. Lucky for the state and county in this situation, one of the private landowners who's been involved in the development of this new road has agreed to basically foot the entire bill. And Mitch Roth said that this road just wouldn't be happening if it weren't for a broad partnership of many stakeholders.
One of the owners who was willing to put up the majority of the cost, maybe all of the costs, had to get permission from a couple of other owners. They also needed the permission from the state, which they were told in previous administrations that they would never get. We were able to reach out to Ed Sniffen, our director of transportation, and we've started talks with him again before August 8th, and they've been really great to work with. So that's been a great partnership, because that wouldn't happen unless the state was on board. It wouldn't happen unless the Waikoloa Community Association, who owns property, got involved, or the other owners.
So I'm sure that's a pretty unusual situation, because, you know, there are not that many other landowners that might be willing to do that.
Right. And I think it's important to note also that just building more roads in and of itself isn't necessarily the whole strategy. I spoke with Stephen Wong earlier in the week, and he studies transportation how transportation systems function in disaster. And he said, once you build a road, you have to have people know where the road is and how to drive it. So that's been part of Waikoloa's strategy as well since the Mauna Road fires. They've been conducting these kind of regular public education events where they invite people to the road, they drive down it safely. It's still at this point a one-lane road, so you have to be able to drive carefully in one direction in kind of an orderly fashion. But beyond that, in the case of Waikoloa, building out infrastructure is really important, because that town is projected to grow in a big way. Mitch Roth pointed out that Hawaii Island, like the rest of the state, is experiencing a serious housing crisis. And Waikoloa is home to a lot of the new affordable housing projects that the county is rolling out. They already have a handful that have been completed. In some instances, residents have already moved in. And they just actually launched a new affordable housing dashboard, I believe on July 19th, that shows you all of the projects they have across the islands. And there's 800 units in the pipeline for Waikoloa in the next couple of years. So that shows you, just from the affordable housing side, how much Waikoloa, a town of about 7,500 people, is expected to grow. But private land developers are also in the midst, too. One of the things that makes Waikoloa desirable is it's located directly above Kona Coast Resort Strip, where many, many people who live on the west side of the island live. So there's a lot of people coming to this town, and one of the things that makes evacuation slower and more challenging is trying to funnel more people down one exit point.
Yeah, we don't need gridlock, you know, like we saw with the tsunamis, in recent years, where it was just a standstill, right? People headed up for higher ground, and the roads are choked.
Exactly, and that's what Mitch Roth described when he called for an evacuation in 2021 with that Mauna Road fire, when folks were trying to get out primarily on the major road that they have down to the highway below, Queen Kaha'umanu Highway. It took some people like 2 hours in their car to safely make that journey. And that drive, under normal circumstances, only takes about 10 minutes. So if you're adding hundreds of new people to that community, and in the case of a disaster, hundreds of more cars on the road, you really need to plan your infrastructure accordingly.
Yeah, and we've seen, here on Oahu, where I know the military has opened up its access road, I think, by Kolikoli Pass, right? So if the community out there on the west side needs to get out safely, that at least they have those routes that the military can open.
Exactly. And I think it's important, too, that everyone, and this is true of any community, that everyone knows what the evacuation strategy is ahead of any disaster. Big Island, of course, is called Big Island for the reason. So its communities are really remote. Waikoloa is this town that's kind of set in this just sea of dry grass with all of this remote landscape around it, really old ranch land that's lying fallow. And it takes a while for emergency responders to get to and respond to fires in the area, as it would any of those remote communities. So folks need to be ready to get in their cars and know where they're going if there's a disaster.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah, for your reporting.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Our reporter series looking at fire vulnerability around our state continues through the end of the week. You can read more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, celebrating 120 years in Hawaii and working to provide renewable, locally sourced energy options to fuel the next 120 years. HawaiiGas.com.
Military analysts use war games to prepare for a range of conflict scenarios between the U.S. and China. Some of them are dire.
I'm not trying to ruin your day or give you nightmares, but this means that the idea of nuclear war over Taiwan is for real.
Taiwan, the center of tension between two nuclear-armed powers. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters should contact their county elections division right away if they have not received their primary election ballot. Elections.hawaii.gov.
You may know actor and writer Kalani Kuepo from his recent work in television shows like Hawaii Five-0 and Fear the Walking Dead. Kuepo was born and raised on Oahu and graduated from McKinley High School. He and his writing partner, Chadwick Johnson, were recently commissioned by not one, but two theaters on the continent, one in Los Angeles and one in Minnesota. They were asked to pen a play for children. Kuepo initially turned down the opportunity, but eventually accepted. The result? A musical titled The Mainlanders. It focuses on an 11-year-old Hawaiian boy named Kimo who returns to Hawaii after his family moved away. The play explores themes of belonging as Kimo navigates bullying at school and his friendship with his ex-con uncle who teaches Kimo to play music. The Conversation's Russell Subiono recently talked with Kuepo about the play.
What was it about this fish out of water, fish returning back to the water story that really appealed to you, that you wanted to explore and share?
Oh, man. Russell, I love that you get the heart of things, right? And that comes from, like, that experience of what it's like to be priced out of Hawaii, right? As people grew up there and we go outside and not just like, oh, because Hawaii too expensive. There's opportunities out there and there are reasons and there's also resources that we can travel. We can go to the mainland. And it was interesting to me because for me growing up in Hawaii, that was always a dream, right? Like, oh, what would that be like to leave the Hawaiian Islands and right. travel to the mainland? And I never got to do that when I was a kid. I mean, I think I probably should correct myself. I understand that when I was an infant, I was taken to the mainland, you know, but right. of course, I don't remember that. But it was a big deal for me to move away. So I think here's the interesting thing. I'm going to be honest with you. When I first was invited to submit a proposal for this multi-generational family piece, I said no, I declined. And the reason why was I thought, you know, I'm super interested in the human experience. And the material that I write tends to be very adult, right? Like I like to dive deep and I want to get deep. So I declined saying, writing for kids and young audiences, I don't think that doesn't appeal to me, right? And I'm so glad I got convinced later, like, hey, rethink this, because you get to write what you want and you're going to be supported in a great way. So, you know, reconsider. So I was like, okay, I'm going to write what I want. So like, as you know, like there's subject matter, they're like being in prison and, you know, stuttering and things that are a little dangerous, you know, to see on stage. And in fact, kind of like very dangerous to explore, in the sense that we haven't seen that a lot for young family audiences. And I love that they not only got from our proposal what we wanted to dive deep into, but actually encouraged it and said, man, these are interesting. You know, we've all seen many storylines about getting bullied, but man, to see stuttering on a stage, to see music incorporated, and to see an uncle who's this unlikely father figure, like recently back from federal prison, you know, all these really interesting things. And I felt encouraged to write the story that came about, and it turned into something really great. So to answer your question, you know, moving away, the idea of the mainland isn't just geographical, it's about perspective and understanding stories and being introduced to cultural aspects of Hawaii. But until like you're there, it affects you in a specific way. And I think that's what's so exciting about this is, what does that feel like when a kid who has this polarized sense of what his world is taken away from that island lifestyle and put in this environment with all these high stakes, right? Like trying to build a relationship with a father he never knew, and then returning to it, and what that means to be like, you sound so mainland, you know, like you sound so haole, you know, and what that feels like, and to be dealing with all of the things that are so like magnified in this 11-year-old life. And I will tell you that it's been a wonderful thing, because there's such great opportunity in this story that we get to share language, we get to share music that is specific to Hawaii. And it's so exciting. I've never seen that. When I was growing up, I was lucky that public schools created opportunities for us to see stage plays. They were always about the mainland, you know, or like universal stories. It's like, oh yeah, I could relate, you know, and I never had that, like, wow, what is it like to see myself on stage? You know, what is it like to see people who sound and feel and remind me of my family and my friends and my neighbors, you know? So I think this is such a great opportunity. And I really thanked my friend who encouraged me to follow through and just see what happens. Go propose your cuckoo idea and see how they respond, you know? And man, they just welcomed it with open arms. And I told them, I was like, you know what? This project has turned into this love letter to my 11-year-old self. And I did not realize that. I just thought, oh, I'm writing something about, you know, this kid and this uncle and whatever. And that's the thing that's so like rewarding about writing, is that you think when you're writing, you know, other characters, other storylines, of course, this one seems kind of way personal, you know, like this is one of the few stories. In fact, this is probably the only story that I've written that takes place in Hawaii that is actually like being supported in a commercial way, meaning there's actually like entities and companies and arts organizations that are saying, hey, we see value in that and we want to see more. And we want to help you to take that to the stage, or, you know, whatever, you know, other projects that I have. So this is where I'm feeling it the most right now. So it's been a really unexpected, gratifying process for myself.
And from what you described about the plotline and the characters, it also sounds like there's this underlying theme of finding your people, or like finding your tribe. And I think that can be a very impactful theme for kids to take away from any kind of story.
I love that. Russell, I love that you're catching these nuances, and all from just us having a short conversation about it, right? And I think that is absolutely it, because, you know, these kids, we end up having these three main kids, and they end up somehow navigating and inviting the fourth kid, which is the bully, into this experience and this storyline that is so wonderful because they're like this motley crew. And man, I get emotional thinking about it because you have these kids on stage who are constantly trying to figure this out. And this is the way we envision the story, right? Chadwick and I talk about it, and that's what's so important to us, is you're on this journey where these 11-year-old kids who all are battling something in their life that has to do specifically with Ohana, right? Finding their people, finding their Ohana. And it gets addressed in a very direct way, but we get to see these kids figure it out. Instead of having these adults saying, now, this is the way you should think about things. You know, here's the lesson that you should learn, young ones. And instead, you see these kids who are like really figuring things out. And then you see a divide between the generations, like between him and his like mom and uncle's age. And then the difference between him, you know, and like the teachers, and then him and his tutu, and how everybody plays a part. And I'll tell you, we had our first developmental workshop in May. So this is the first time that we were outside of a room of me and Chadwick, and then maybe like people from Native Voices Theater and Children's Theater Company. And we actually had kids, amazing kids to work with in Minneapolis. And we had it in a small invited audience to experience this in sort of like a concert version, right? Just music stands, the script, and we just presented a few of the songs. But we did all the dialogue from beginning to end. So right before we were going to do it, I got up, I introduced myself, and I introduced what the project was about. And I said, I think of this as like Chadwick and I had this tiny little baby that we're rearing. And we've all heard and known the expression that it takes a village. And I said, you know, it's so interesting because we had this baby and here we are with the first time that we're going to be sharing this with you. We've added on people from Children's Theater Company and Native Voices Theater. And in a way, they've become like the aunties and uncles for this baby, right? And then I said, now we've got this audience. We've got all these kids who are working on it. So now we got cousins for this baby. And we were all caring for this child because we want this child. We all want to nurture this child and have this child grow up and grow into something that has a voice that has an impact on our future keikis, our future generations, you know? And it's just become this really beautiful process. I've been fortunate enough to work in film and television. And I always say this, you know, when people ask, well, what's the difference? Because you came from theater, that's what you studied, and you were able to add film and television, right? And, you know, like, what's the difference for you? And yeah, there are technical aspects that we can talk about. But I think the biggest thing that I would articulate is that theater is really, truly about the process. And the process involves the ohana that comes together for whatever project, right? And there's this long process. Whereas film and television, oftentimes it's just like, okay, show up at the audition and give them the end result of what they'd like to see. And then show up on set and again, give them what you did at the audition, the end result, so that they can piece that all together and edit it into something. And that can be a lonely feeling sometimes, right? Because you feel sort of isolated or polarized, and then you kind of fit in and it's fast and furious. Sometimes you're just on set for a day. Other times you're there for a few weeks or a few months. But with theater, there is a specific process. And then I feel like I've been able to extend that process because I'm not just coming in as an actor, you know, once all the development is happening in the writing process and the song development process. So I get to be at it from the very beginning. So I'm in love with the process, and I think it's so gratifying.
Thank you so much, Kalani Kwepo. Really appreciate your time, man.
All right, Russell.
All right, Kalani.
That was actor and Oahu native Kalani Kwepo talking with HVR's Russell Subiono. Kwepo says edits to the Mainlanders continues, but the play is close to being finalized.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
Aloha, I'm Anita Rao, host of Embodied, a new program on Hawaii Public Radio. Sex and relationships can be intimidating to talk about, so I am here to lead the way. Join me as we explore our brains and our bodies, a journey that touches down in taboo territory. Embodied is Sundays at 10 a.m. on HPR One.
You know, it's the last day of July, which means Keiki will be returning to school soon, and opportunities to spend summer days at the beach will begin to dwindle. One woman who's built her business on family spending time at the beach while also joining the effort to reduce plastic at our beaches is Oahu resident Katie Ryman. She's the owner of Rogue Wave Toys, which has developed a beach set for kids made from compostable plastic. The conversations, Russell Subiano sat down with Ryman in our studios a year ago to talk about how she came up with the idea and her journey to bring the product to market.
I came up with this idea, I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but after a day at the beach with my kids. We were living on the East Coast at the time, and we had a conventional plastic beach toy set that they were playing with, and it had lots of parts to it. And the kids were playing on shore, and this wave came and took all of their toys out into the ocean, and I sort of went into high alert and was like, not on my watch, like hyper aware of the plastic pollution problem that we have, especially in the ocean. And so I'm like running into the ocean trying to pull back all these beach toys, and I collect them all back on shore. And I kind of had this moment where I'm like sitting on shore looking up and down at all of the material that we bring with us to the beach. And I was like, what are we doing? You know, we're interfacing here with the ocean, and it's like we're bringing the problem right to it. And that's an oversimplification, I think, of how plastic gets into the ocean. But it was this really dramatic sort of lightning bolt moment for me. Like, I have to make this better.
You did bring the set in with you today.
Well, it's been a long time from that first moment on the beach to now. It's been about 7 years total. And so just the other day, I got the order that I had placed, like a sample order. I just wanted to see what my customers were going to see and receive it the way my customers were going to receive it. And so that order came in the mail just a couple of days ago, and I couldn't open it. I was very excited that it arrived, and I'm seeing friends and family and customers open it on Instagram. They're sending me photos, but I couldn't bring myself to open it. And it sat there, and I was sort of hoping for inspiration, like there will be a right moment. And the right moment came just before coming down to the studio, because I just wanted you to be able to see it. So you forced my hand there, which is a good thing.
You're good. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to pass it over to me, and I'm going to check it out.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So here we go. Over to you.
All right. So from the pictures I've seen and from the product that I have right here in my hand, it looks like a pretty standard bucket set that you would get for a kid in a store, you know, like in Walmart or Target, for them to play at the beach. I'm going to open up this. You sure you're okay if I...
I'm okay. I'm okay. Ready. I'm ready. Do it.
All right. So I'm going to break the label on here. Mm-hmm. So the bucket is square in shape, and it's a light blue color. On top of it is a... In my head, I want to say sieve, but it's...
Sifter.
Sifter. Mm-hmm. It's an orange sifter. It's square. It's shallow. It looks like a brownie pan. And then inside is the shovel. The shovel reminds me of what bakers would use to like scoop out sugar. To make things.
And if you look through the handle, you'll see it's hollow.
Oh.
And that's for our Drip Castle fans.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So they can make some Drip Castles with their... With their shovel.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. And it feels like plastic. I mean, it feels like plastic that toys are made of, but it's compostable.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the process that you went through? Were you involved in designing, you know, like how the plastic was made? Is it still plastic? Do you still call it plastic?
I still call it plastic because I just don't know another term for it yet. And I think it's easier for consumers, right, to label it something we know. When I, you know, came home from that beach trip 7 years ago, I didn't know, I wasn't committed to it being a plastic necessarily. I just wanted to make something that would disappear at the end of its life. And so I actually started with a mushroom fiber, which was interesting. I was making it in my kitchen. I was baking it. It grows, you know, it was like really interesting science experiment, but not the right material. But it was good to sort of check out the landscape of different possibilities for materials. And it was really tough. I mean, it took a really long time. The failed mushroom material was several months in the making. And then ultimately, I ended up finding a 3D print filament that worked. I'm really abbreviating the story here, but I started the whole thing when we lived in outside of Washington, D.C., which is where I was prototyping the mushroom-based material. And then we moved to Hawaii and I purchased a 3D printer and I was like, well, I have the design. You know, I hired a product designer. We designed this, what you see in front of you. Let me see if I can at least 3D print this and see if the design works with this plant-based 3D print filament. And so that's what we did. And it worked. It wasn't nearly as sturdy as you see it now with the 3D printer. So I knew we were going to have to move to an injection mold. And I decided that that 3D print material was a known quantity. And so what if we could just alter it slightly and turn it into a material that's capable of being injection molded? And so that's what we did. And that took several years, but we did it.
So how does it compost? Say, for instance, you know, it breaks apart or it breaks down. Kids break things. I mean, I have four kids and they very easily push toys to the limits. So if it were to break and it was no longer functional in the way it was meant to be functional, how would somebody compost it?
Yeah. So this is a question I'm asked a lot. And we would ideally want everyone to return these to an industrial compost facility. Now, the catch is there are not many industrial compost facilities in the United States. And so if I had billions of dollars, we would be setting up, you know, satellite take-back stations so that everybody could compost these properly. But in lieu of that, they will also compost in active landfill to energy sites. So that's just your sort of run-of-the-mill landfill. It depends on the, you know, what's happening in all of these places. If the toy is broken, how many places is the toy broken? Mm-hmm. Is the toy whole? That's going to change how quickly it takes to break down, but ultimately the product is going to break down and convert back into that compost material, that soil, which is really unique from the, you know, the counterpart, which does not break down, right? It breaks right. down, but it doesn't ever disappear.
Right. It just breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like the smaller it breaks down, it feels like the more dangerous it becomes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to a handful of people who have been doing research on plastics pollution and marine debris. What kind of research did you do to get a better understanding of, you know, what plastics are dangerous, why they're dangerous, and how to find another, a different material that breaks down better, composts better?
Well, I was aware of the sort of these gyres that we have at the outset of this journey, these gyres in the ocean full of debris and plastics. But the more I've been in this space, the more I've learned and the more, I mean, I don't want to sound alarmist, but like the more frightening it becomes because it is so pervasive. And these initiatives, the UN initiatives, I think they're really important, but I also think they have to be working in tandem with other initiatives like alternative materials. Recycling the plastics that we already have is a great use of the plastics we currently have. But as you know, we can only recycle plastics so many times before they're rendered sort of non-usable because we've changed the properties so many times. And so I think just introducing the concept of an alternative to a conventional plastic is really important because this doesn't have to be the answer, but it can be part of the solution. And I hope that there are lots of other companies that are inspired to follow suit, because we know that, you know, it's not just plastics in the ocean. We know that we're consuming a credit card's worth of plastic in a week. That's pretty gross. We know it's everywhere, Mount Everest, it's in the Great Lakes in Michigan. But also, to get to a plastic product, what do we have to do? We have to extract oil. There's a huge carbon footprint on the front end of these plastics. And so to help reduce that by introducing alternatives, I think is really important, so that we can work towards those UN goals, but we can also sort of come at it from all sides, right? I really believe there's not just one solution. My product and this material is not a silver bullet, but I do think that it is sort of a way to inspire other alternatives, and also to inspire us to think about the way we consume products. I mean, I own a beach toy company, and I am asking people, do you really need a beach toy? Do you need a beach toy, right? Like, what are we making and buying that we really need versus making just to turn a profit? I think we have to really reconsider the way that we make products and the way that we buy products.
Where can people out there get this beach set?
Everyone can get it online at roguewavetoys.com. And we're working on our wholesale customers, so hopefully soon here on Oahu and beyond.
Kate, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming down to the studio to talk story with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Rogue Wave Toys owner Kate Ryman talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Ryman shared with us this morning that she received her patent for the beach toy set just a couple of months ago. She said that the set is available at Full Circle Farms in Waimanalo, in addition to her website. We'll have a link on our website later today. We now go to this week's Mono Minute. We have got the song of the shy Japanese bush warbler, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Japanese bush warblers are small, mostly brownish songbirds with a distinct white eyebrow or superciliary line above their eyes. Because they spend most of their time in dense understory vegetation, they're really hard to see, but it's their loud, very distinctive song that gives them away. There are two main types of song. The first has a long introductory whistle ending in a syllable. The second is mostly a long descending series of double notes. Known as uguisu in Japanese, they're one of the best known and loved songbirds in Japan. And after a long winter, that song is viewed as one of the first signs of spring. It's sung only by the males to advertise their territories and try to attract females. These birds are also highly regarded for their droppings, which are the main ingredient in a very effective skin cream that's been used in Japan for centuries. Hawaii is the only place in the world where Japanese bush warblers have become established outside their natural range. They were first introduced to Oahu in 1929 to control insects, and expanded on their own to all the other main Hawaiian islands, most recently making the long flight to the Big Island in the 1990s. Sexes are similar in plumage, but the males are almost half again as heavy as the females. Unlike most other songbirds that are monogamous, male Japanese bush warblers are polygynous, where a male sets up a territory and pairs up with multiple nesting females. Japanese bush warblers are found in a variety of native and non-native forests across the state and seem particularly attracted to areas of dense uluhe fern, where there are often very few other bird species. We still don't know a lot about their ecology here in Hawaii, but at least for now, they don't seem to be having a significant negative impact on our native birds or forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, committed to helping preserve, protect, and restore the biological diversity of Hawaii Island. friendsofhakalauforest.org.
You know, we were fortunate to have special musical guests from Madeira Island in Portugal on our show yesterday. They brought us the story and the sounds of two of the folk instruments that gave rise to the ukulele that we know today. This morning, we've got a story closer to home with the Ook Connection. It showcases a state-of-the-art recording studio at Washington Middle School. We recently got wind of a collaboration with State Archivist Adam Jansen and ukulele collector Sean Yakovone at the studio. They plan to record music played on antique ukuleles and preserve the sound of these priceless instruments in a digital archive. The studio itself has been 8 years in the making at the school that serves a low-income community in the McCully area. Principal Michael Hirano says it cost the Department of Education about $3 million to design, construct, and outfit the studio with top-of-the-line recording equipment and instruments. But why build a world-class studio in a small public school in town? The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently took a tour of the new space with Line Studio Director Sam Fong.
So the studio is right up there with the whole air conditioning unit. The duct of the air conditioning is really long. That's because the studio has to be very quiet. So it's like almost like a silencer, like a gun silencer. They absorb the sound and slow down the air just enough to get into the studio. And so that it can be quiet. So this is our studio, Line Studio at WMS. What you're entering into is actually it's a sound lock of the studio. There's always a space between the isolated room and the outside world. So this is actually the isolated hallway before you enter into the theater, the studio in our case. This is the least treated room. But the door in itself is actually it's not just a door, it's an isolation door. When you open the door here, you can really feel, you can really feel the breath in exchange as you enter into this studio. But this room is not just a hallway, it's also a recording room. May I show you the most boring room? So this is the machine room. All of the signal of this whole studio is actually will come into this space here. Over 6,000 connection points has to be connected in this system with no mistakes. So we're going into the next room. The official name for a studio space is the large room in the, like a commercial grade studio. We call it the live room, but we call it Kalo room. So, you can go in and take a look. The backstory is that I will go to the National Association for Music Merchants Organizations conference pretty much every year. So I, got to the convention in Anaheim, and I went into the convention center and I saw this posting that say Dream Studio Workshop. You've got a whole panel of who's who studio designer. And then John Story came up. He's talking about Jazz and Lincoln Center, Jay-Z, Alicia Keys Studio, none of which I can really relate. So I took a deep breath. I saw all these people line up to talk to him. I said, it's going to be my turn. So I went up and I said, Mr. Stark, my name is Sam Fong. And I told him about our urban school. We have many under-resourced students coming to this school. So at that time, it's still a Washington Middle School project. Since then, we have expanded to really a Department of Education studio. So I asked him, would he be interested to build a studio for us? He looked at me. I thought he was going to say, get out of here. No, he didn't. He said, of course I will. I met John Story in 2016. Now it's 2024, right? So it was 8 years ago. And then the building process. Building a recording studio is a different animal. And I didn't know that most people who build a studio don't want to build it again. It's not the best way to make money. You have to love it. Even at an ideal situation, it would have taken a few years, but we have COVID. That took another 2 years. We cannot get stuff and all of that. So to this point, we just finished. We can kind of say we'll never finish, but we can say we finished. It's 8 years. So at this point, we have students that have come in. not this particular school, but we have students that came in to experience this studio, but we have not officially opened to students yet. So we are actually going into soft opening. I'm excited to show you this. This piano here is just like any acoustic piano. Now, I don't play piano, but you can just kind of hear it, right? So it's like an acoustic piano. But what makes this piano really special is that in order to get this piano, we really have to show the DOE that this piano can do something that no other piano in the world can do. So not only the piano is acoustical, someone can play the piano here. If someone has a Discovere system in their piano, you know, say in Germany, you play here, that piano will start playing. Or it can go the other way. You can just imagine, you can open up collaboration with our artists and artists around the world, but it also elevate remote learning. The mass of somebody can actually teach. They can play, and you can see them play here in this piano. So let me just demonstrate a little bit. Let's see if I can. You know, my mom taught me, if you're going to do anything, do it the best that you can. Do it really, really well. Don't worry about too many other things. Just build the best. People naturally would gravitate toward the best. So the idea of, okay, we're going to build a studio. Let's build the best. If we have the resource, first build the best. But also, Kitayashi, our superintendent, and our principal, Michael Harano, they really believe in contextualized learning. So when our kids come in, I really believe that they need to walk into a contextualized room. Like even for preschooler, early childhood, they have to play in a real playground, not a virtual playground. Otherwise, they don't know how it feels to touch sand, touch grass, feel the wind. So that's the reason why we will build such a contextualized, like a real recording studio for our young people to experience. It takes a lot of commitment for the legislators to entrust that financial support for our principal and for Department of Education to build. It is a high cost item. The objective is to get at least 2 to 3 times a return. Just this building alone, I think that we actually spend the money really, really well. A studio of this class attracts a lot of attention from our local and international artists. In this studio, first, we're attracting people. It doesn't have to be musician. We actually are partnering with Adam Jensen. He's an archivist at the State Archive. So he will be doing projects here, recording some of the most prehistorical instruments. Just that one project alone. And with Sean Yakavon, who we are also partnering, he, of all the pre-1900 ukuleles, which is our state instrument, he owns, I think, over 60 to 70% of the pre-1900 ukulele. That's insane. So they're going to bring in this instrument with the top artists of the state to perform those instruments. We're going to capture it. That's the context, right? So these great artists, great instrument, great producer walking in, smart people like Adam and Sean. And then our kids, even if they sit in for that 1 hour, you wonder what they're going to get from it. Check this out now. In this studio, we have 2 official isolation rooms. These sliding doors can go all the way to the last panel. Our designer's idea, is that the room can expand to a larger room. It's also changed its acoustics too, so it's very flexible. Come on in. May I show you the last room? So this is called a Kai room, water. The idea is that everything flows into this room. No matter what anyone do, it's going to have to come into this room for capturing and processing and mixing and post-mixing and so forth. What you hear is actually will translate in the radio station, in someone's car, someone's TV, someone's $1 million stereo to a little radio clock. Now today, you go to a lot of music classes, because I was a music teacher, I was a band teacher, and you'll see much cheaper instruments. Here's the problem with those cheaper instruments. Say, you know, I like your example, ukulele. the fretboard, the finger, the action is so much harder for a kid with even less developed motor skill to try to hold a string down onto the neck of the ukulele. And then the tuning is really hard because the tuning peg keep getting loose on a cheaper instrument. Where we used to have Kamaka ukulele, and it's well built. You can actually tune it. So is it worth it? Could they damage it? Yeah, they can. They could damage a Kamaka ukulele, perhaps happen. But what you also do is that it forces us as educators to elevate our skill level on management, on understanding how to actually make the best of these high-end equipment. Rather than, well, it's cheap, right? So then our children will leave the classroom just learning mediocrity. Why would we want to do that? So if we want to elevate that level, now, we have obviously incredible equipment. Now, you see the Asperger speaker, ATC speakers. What are those speakers going to do? You give them clarity and detail that they never have heard before. They already have the sensors, their ears. They can hear it. But if you don't give them the opportunity to hear what sound actually sound like, how would they know? So there's a risk that I'm willing to take. At the overhead. Okay, now I'm going to put some ambiance. This mic is about 3-4 feet away from the drums. So now I'm going to bring the bass. Electric guitar. You know, I was reading magazines like, man, if I get to be in Capitol Record, because one of my heroes is Al Schmidt. I don't even heard of him. He passed away recently. He was the head of Capitol Record. And we'll talk about his mixes. And he'll talk about the room when Frank Sinatra walked in. And then I'm going to mic them this way and that way. And I would imagine. But the problem is that I don't have that kind of space. But once you get to be hang out in the studio and spend a lot of time, you really now know how masters work in their kitchen. I certainly can teach band. But I really don't think that's my purpose. So I used to feel like, gee, you know, I'm not as good as that band director or this band director or that wind player or that whatever. I didn't realize that's actually not my purpose. Then when I sit on these mixing consoles, start doing, you know, audio work, I realize, oh, that's me. That's my purpose. And so all of a sudden, you can elevate to a different level that you thought you never can. So, you know, finding the right instrument, whatever that may be being a doctor or maybe being an engineer, audio engineer, just really find that purpose so that you can be the best that you can be. So that's really our mission.
Well, that was Washington Middle Studio Director Sam Fong in a segment produced by HPR's Maddie Bender. And a school principal, Michael Hirano, told us that seeing the studio now was worth all the pain and suffering it took to make it happen. Congrats on their soft opening. Well, we're out of time now, but tomorrow we plan to check in with some residents displaced by the Maui wildfires as next month marks a year since that disaster hit. Got a story to share about that time, you know, recorded on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can search the Conversation podcast on Google, Spotify, or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the Conversation.